Hello, welcome to The Rest is History and Happy New Year. We have finally reached 2022 and we've finally reached the 1st of January in our 12 or 13 days of Christmas. So Tom Holland, to bring in the new year, what jolly, upbeat, laugh-a-minute story have you chosen for us?
Well, it's a Roman story, and I think that's appropriate because we celebrate the 1st of January as the new year because of the Romans.
Yeah. Was it the first day of the year for them? Was that March, I thought?
Yes, it was, but it was the first day of the civil year.
Right.
So it's when the consuls, who are the two magistrates who during the Republican period served as the kind of preeminent magistrates in the Republic, it's when they took office. And from the second century BC onwards, and increasingly under the Caesars, it comes to be enshrined as the start of the year more generally as well.
Yeah.
So I think we talked about that, didn't we? We talked on an episode about New Year and about Janus, the two-headed god who looks both ways. And so under the empire, under the Caesars, the 1st of January is not only the day in which the consuls head up onto the Capitol, which is the sacred hill with the great shrine of Jupiter, and sacrifices made there, and the auguries are taken, and people look to the future. But it's also a day in which offerings are kind of made, sacrifices are made to for the good of Caesar.
Right.
And in AD 68, that is the year, it's the last year of Nero's life, and he goes up there. And notoriously, what happens on that day is, first of all, they can't find the keys to the temple of Capitoline Jove.
So that's ominous.
That's an ominous. But the other ominous thing that happens is that Sporus, who a friend of the show, the poor boy who has been castrated and turned into the spitting image of Nero's dead wife, Poppaea Sabina, as a gift, gives Nero a ring on which Persephone is shown being raped by Hades, the king of the underworld, and taken down into the depths of the kingdom of the dead.
It's quite a strong present, I would say.
All kinds of subliminal messages are being sent
there. Especially what's been going on with Sporus.
Yes, exactly. So it's remembered subsequently as a somber moment where Nero's downfall, which happens over the course of the following months, is set in train. And it's set in train by a Gallo-Roman aristocrat called Julius Vindex, who declares that, you know, Nero's, you know, he's beyond the pale. He's gone too far. He's right. Raising the banner of rebellion. And this serves to trigger a rebellion in Spain and encourages an old school kind of figure of Republican aristocratic virtue called Galba, who is the governor of one of the provinces in Spain, to declare himself emperor.
Yeah.
Nero is toppled, commits suicide, and the Senate accept Galba as emperor. And Galba crosses from Spain through Gaul, down through Italy, and enters Rome. And so on the 1st of January 69 AD, he is the emperor.
Yeah.
So he is going through the rituals that the year before Nero had done. Now, these rituals do not just take place in Rome. They take place in cities across the empire, and most significantly, they take place in legionary bases. And these legionary bases are dotted mainly around the frontiers, not exclusively, but mainly. And the largest concentration of these legionary bases are along the Rhine, because the Rhine obviously is adjacent to Germany that the Romans had attempted to conquer. They then lost three legions to Varus in AD 9. Varus's three legions have been lost to Arminius in AD 9.
Teutoburg Forest.
And the Romans kind of, they inflict devastating punishment on the Germans for it. And they essentially decide the Germans don't deserve to be conquered. That's their attitude.
Yeah.
So they build these line of bases along the Rhine. And that means that there's a huge concentration of manpower there. Now, these Rhine legions, they had marched against Julius Vindex in the summer, not because they were loyal to Nero, but because they saw Julius Vindex not as a Roman, but as a Gallic rebel. And there'd been attempts to negotiate, but basically between the commander of the Rhine legions and Julius Vindex. But the legions wanted to have a punch up. They wanted a chance to wipe out Julius Vindex's men, who were all Gauls.
Right.
And that would then license them to plunder Gaul.
I was about to say, there must be Gaul some reason other than just fighting. There must be booty.
They would have a big punch up and they want booty.
Yeah.
And they're not allowed to do this. And basically it's Galba who stops them from doing it. And Galba sends them packing back to the Rhine bases. So they're really, really cross about this. And they dislike Galba because Galba had been in command on the Rhine frontier. And he was a tremendous kind of martinet. He was an old school stickler. And they didn't like it. He was kind of... Legionaries were perfectly capable of respecting stern disciplinarians, but they had to be charismatic as well. And it's kind of Football Manager, Dominic, all that stuff that you were doing when you should have been.
You're comparing Galba's administration of the Rhine legions to my managerial career and championship manager in the late 1990s.
There are managers who can be incredible sticklers for discipline and who nobody likes. And then there can be managers who are incredible sticklers for discipline and the players absolutely adore them and will do anything for them.
Exactly.
Galba was a stickler without charisma.
He's not Alex Ferguson, basically.
He's not Alex Ferguson, no. So they don't like him. And that means that when the 1st of January comes and the time comes for them to go to the Principia, which is the kind of the central great hall, the great shrine in the middle of each legionary base, to pay their respects to the standards, the eagles, that is the symbol for each legion, but also the statues of the emperor. And it's a way basically of kind of renewing, it's a public affirmation of loyalty to the serving emperor. And this is incredibly important this year of all years, because Galba, unlike the previous lines of emperors, he has no claim to be a part of the family of Augustus, who is the founder of this imperial dynasty. So for the first time, someone is ruling as Caesar who does not belong to the family of the Caesars. So you have all these bases. You have bases in what are called Lower Germany, which is the Upper Rhine, the Rhine nearest the North Sea. And then you have Upper Germany, which is going further towards the source. The legions of Lower Germany, with no great enthusiasm, are persuaded to basically kind of swear loyalty, swear their sacramentum, their kind of oath of loyalty to Galba. In Upper Germany, it's different. There is a massive troublemaker by the name of Aulus Caecina. And Caecina actually had been a colleague in Spain of Galba's.
Oh, so he hates him.
No, had actually kind of swung round behind him.
No, okay.
Together with a man called Otho, who would be a friend of Nero. So Otho,
you love
Caecina,
him. You love Otho.
Otho Caecina and Vitellius. So Otho Caecina and Galba, between them, had kind of mustered the forces of Spain that had then enabled Galba to become emperor. Otho had gone with Galba to Rome, but by Caecina, who was very young, had been given command of the senior legion in a double legionary base at a place called Mogontiacum, which today is Mainz.
Okay.
And this is a huge promotion. He's been promoted massively above, his age qualifications. So Caecina should be happy with this, but he's not, because he's a man in a hurry and he's stuck out in the snow and drizzle of the Rhine while Otho is back in Rome whooping it up. And of course, as it turns out, plotting. And Caecina basically decides that he wants to expedite his career even faster. And so over the course of 69, he's been engaging in all kinds of corrupt practices and he's been caught red-handed, and Galba wants to bring him to trial. And so this threatens the total ruin of his career. So Caecina decides on the 1st of January, he's got nothing to lose. And so he stirs up a mutiny, and the legion he's in command of, and then the other legion that's sharing this camp, they all smash the statues of Galba. They reject his claim to be a legitimate Caesar. They swear an oath of loyalty not to any individual candidate, because there isn't an available one, but to the Senate and people of Rome.
Okay.
But of course, they are immediately looking around for someone else who might be able to take Galba's place. So even Caicino recognises that he can't do that. He's too young. He's too junior. He lacks the prestige to be a credible Caesar. So basically, it needs to be either the governor of Upper Germany or Lower Germany. The governor of Upper Germany has one of the more amusing Roman names. I mean, he's called Hordonius Flaccus, which, okay. I mean, it kind of sounds like something out of Viz.
Yeah.
And he's a hopeless figure. He is a flaccid figure. He's not a hard on. He's not going to be a good Caesar. Right. And so they look at the guy who is, you know, up the Rhine, who's the governor there, and it's a guy called Vitellius.
Very fat.
Now Vitellius, as you say, he's very, very fat. That's the thing.
Isn't there something that Suetonius says about him, that when he was marching, he'd often like stop and like eat a pie and stuff, and then
He loves his pies. Yeah, he loves his pies
or something.
Yeah, but he's a man of he has kind of distinguished pedigree. He's actually, despite the fact that Suetonius and Tacitus both kind of blacken his name because he ends up, he's a bit of a loser. He has a distinguished record. He's perfectly serviceable as a candidate. And one of the things that's actually rather impressive about him is that he knows his own inadequacies. And so when a messenger is sent by Caecina galloping all the way up to what's now Cologne, where Vitellius has his headquarters, and bursting in, and of course Vitellius is at dinner, which causes huge amusement.
He's always at dinner.
Vitellius kind of, you know, says, you should become Caesar. Vitellius hesitates. And then the next day, one of the commanders from his stretch of the Rhine, a man called Fabius Valens, comes rushing in from the legionary camp at Bonn and likewise says, you know, yes, you must become Caesar. So Vitellius then faces a huge problem, which is he doesn't really want to be Caesar. He knows he won't be a good Caesar.
Yeah.
His mum had been told, so the story goes, when he was born, that if he ever had a military command, it would all end up disastrously. And so he's always been conscious of this. And so he's worried that, this has all been foretold that it's going to end terribly. But he's got this huge problem, because if he's not going to accept the leadership of the mutinous legions as their emperor, then he's going to have to repress the mutiny. Yeah, and he doesn't have any troops. So
he has to go along with it.
Yeah, he's essentially stuck. And then the news comes through from Rome that Galba has been assassinated and replaced by Otho. So you have the situation by the end of January, where in Rome you have Otho, on the Rhine frontier you have Vitellius, and you have troops. So both Caecina and Valens are already leading their troops southwards towards the Alps and Italy. And
that's exciting.
It's all set fair for a year that comes to be known as the Year of the Four Emperors.
I think we should revisit this, Tom.
Well, we should, because I've actually just been writing about it in the book that I am currently in the process of.
So your book, just to give listeners a sneak preview, your book is about, so you've done one on the Julio-Claudians. So from Augustus.
I've done Rubicon, which is about the fall of the Roman Republic. I've done Dynasty, which is about the Julio-Claudians ending with Nero. And this is called Pax. So the peace, the Roman peace. And it begins with Nero's death. We go through the Year of the Four Emperors. So you have Galba, gets murdered by Otho, who gets defeated in battle by Vitellius, who gets defeated and horribly killed by the supporters of Vespasian, who by the end of the year has become emperor. And he then establishes the Flavian dynasty, followed by Titus, who is emperor when Pompey gets destroyed, when the Colosseum is inaugurated, Domitian, who gets assassinated, and then you have Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian. Yeah. And it's bookended by the two events that perhaps in the long run have the most seismic impact in this period, which is the two Jewish revolts, the first of which culminates in the destruction of the temple. The second one culminates effectively in the destruction of the Judean quality of what gets renamed Palestine. So it's a really thrilling, important, fascinating period.
A nice bit of sort of early promotion for your book.
So well, Happy New Year.
When's it out? Next this year? 2022?
No, next year.
2023.
So what are we in now? 2022. Yeah, 2023.
Okay, jolly good. Yeah. That's something to look forward to. Right, and what we've also got to look forward to after the break is my choice for the 1st of January.
Which is also on a Roman theme, isn't it?
Yeah, Romanish. I think we can say Romanish. Yeah, we shall return after the break. Thank you.
Happy New Year, everyone. Welcome back to our 1st of January, 12 Days of Christmas special. In the first half, we had a very, very Roman theme. We were looking at the mutiny on the Rhine in AD 69, the year of the four emperors. And Dominic, your choice is also, you know, it's Roman.
It is Roman. Yeah, it is Roman. So as you know, Tom, I have a long-running sort of hobby. I have a long-running passion for Byzantine history, which I started when I was an undergraduate, and have always been fascinated by, and frankly would have done if I'd had the languages, but I didn't. You couldn't do Latin, or I'd lost all my Latin, never really done any Greek, so I couldn't do anything on it. So I ended up going into American and then British history instead. But deep down, I'd always liked to have done the Age of Iconoclasm or something like that. So anyway,
You've been going all about Christianity.
Yeah, God, how awful that would have been.
Yeah, imagine that. There's an alternate reality.
Maybe I'd have been a very iconoclastic historian. I'd have claimed Christianity.
You said it was all about sociology.
Yeah, that's exactly.
It was all about pots.
Yeah. The pots, I could never get on with the pots, to be brutally honest.
So you don't like pots and you don't like Christianity.
Yeah.
So maybe you love Eastern Indian history.
So maybe I think you were much Empire. Better. I just like eunuchs, though. Blinding, icons, yeah. All those kinds of palaces. Right. So we are in the 11th century. We are on the 1st of January, 1068. And this is the day that a fellow called Romanus IV becomes what we would now call the Emperor of Byzantium. But of course, Emperor of the Romans, right? Emperor of Rome. I mean, this is one of the strange things, I think, for we've never really done an episode on the Byzantine Empire. But one of the interesting things about it is that it's known by a name that none of the people who lived in it.
Well, there are so many that we should do. I mean, we should do a kind of framing episode, shouldn't we?
We should. I mean, I mentioned iconoclasm. I love the subject of iconoclasm because there's little known about it. It's so mysterious. Anyway, we're getting sidetracked. So in the 11th century, the empire of the Romans has become, you know, it's waxed and waned, but it has by and large been reduced to the southern Balkans and what is now largely Turkey. So basically Asia Minor, Anatolia.
But the 11th century, I mean, it had gone through a terrible stage. So we did Charlemagne's coronation.
Yeah.
And it was really on its uppers then.
Yeah.
But over the course of the 10th century into the 11th century, it comes back.
It has come back, yes. So it's mounted tremendous comebacks.
Yeah. The brilliant 10th century emperor, Nicephorus Phocas.
Yeah. He's the fellow, is he, now, does he lose his head or does he sever somebody else's? I can never remember.
He gets assassinated in the palace. But he's an awful great Saracen fighter.
There's all these tremendous characters, Basil the Bulgar Slayer and so on.
So actually, I mean, the thing is that when Romanus IV becomes emperor, the Byzantine Empire is a massive superpower.
It's not doing that badly. I mean, it's not the Roman Empire of Italy, North Africa, Spain, and so on. It's in the Eastern Mediterranean. But you're right; it's rich, it's powerful, it's a very sophisticated place. And if you think that at the same time, you know, this is what 2 years after the Battle of Hastings. I mean, by comparison, you know, the Romans, the people who live in Constantinople, are living lives of kind of gilded splendor, really, compared with their sort of northern rivals. Anyway, so this fellow, he's called Romanus Diogenes, and he's the son of a guy called Constantine Diogenes, and the Diogonoi, the family, they come from what's now Turkey, so from Anatolia. They're a very sort of rich, well-connected, kind of military aristocratic family, a clan. And he has, you know, you talk about people serving on the frontier, the Rhine frontier. So the equivalent in the sort of 11th century is the Danubian frontier. So that's where the Romans of the day have their troops. And he has served in that army. And there are some interesting parallels between the first story and this story, because Romanus is a very popular and successful general. The emperor, Constantine the X, has died in 1067. His wife, who is called Eudokia, has taken over as regent for his sons, who are basically too young to assume the throne themselves. And Romanus clearly thinks, as is very common with Byzantine generals in this era, he clearly thinks, well, you know, I could kind of take over myself. And clearly a lot of soldiers think this. But basically, any plan that he has for a coup goes wrong, and he is taken to Constantinople and taken before Eudokia, who is the regent, who is the widow, and he awaits punishment. Now, in these days, obviously, you could be executed, you could be blinded, you could be forced into a monastery. And you know, the sources aren't great, but you can kind of imagine him there on waiting to find out what his sentence is. And she says, actually, you know what? You seem quite an impressive fellow. I think I might marry you and you can become emperor.
I mean, that's the best, isn't it?
So it's basically that's,
you know, the range of options you have. Yeah, that's
better.
You take that.
That is that. You definitely take that. I mean, yeah. You know, it's tremendous. Well, I mean, given what happens, maybe he would think that he'd have been better off in a monastery. Who knows? Anyway, he becomes emperor. And actually, what's interesting about him is not that this event on the 1st of January, but what happens afterwards. Because as you know, Tom, he is emperor for the next sort of 3 years. And then he leads the Roman, the Byzantine army, into this tremendous battle at a place called Manzikert in 1071, where he's up against a group of people called the Turks. So obviously Celtics. The Turks have come from Central Asia. And they've swept into, or seeped. I mean, it's been quite gradual into kind of Asia Minor, into Anatolia, and they are the big new players, the Seljuk Turks.
But they're intimidated by the Romans' army. They're desperate to make terms.
Yeah, because they're facing the Romans.
I can just crush them.
But no,
it all goes
because
wrong.
At the Battle of Manzikert, it all goes wrong for him, doesn't it? Don't some of his half the army runs away.
And he split his forces, hasn't he?
Yeah.
So it's the classic. He's withdrawing and they're terrible.
It's all a shambles. He's captured. The Seljuk Sultan is a man called Alp Arslan. and he can't believe, Byzantine historians say, he can't believe it when this guy is dragged before him and they say, this is the Roman emperor. You know, this is the heir of Augustus and Constantine and Diocletian and all the Justinian, all these great figures, and this shambolic-looking man covered in dust, battered, and Alp Arslan puts his foot on Romanus. They push Romanus down in the dust, and Alp Arslan puts his foot on Romanus's neck as a sort of symbol. But then actually he treats him with what our Turkish listeners will be pleased to hear, traditional Turkish hospitality.
Yeah.
He raises him takes him to his tent and gives him fine wines and they eat, you know, kebabs or whatever and have a splendid time. Treats him very well. Says they never said a cruel word to him in the 8 days that Romanus spent in the camp. So basically he then releases Romanus and says, you'll give us a treaty and you'll pay a massive ransom. Romanus says, oh yes, absolutely. Then he goes back and the imperial family have basically launched a kind of coup against him, haven't they? The Ducas family. So then there's a whole series of sort of strange feuds and battles. And Romanus he's basically holed up in Adana in the south of Turkey, what's now Turkey. And he's surrounded and he has to surrender and he's given assurances of sort of safety and so on. So he surrenders. So this is the end of 1071. And they've told him, the people who've toppled him from the sort of imperial family, they say, well, you know, we'll let you go. You can go into a monastery and stuff. But they completely break that promise, Tom. Very, very poor form.
Very Byzantine.
They break that promise. And do you know what happens to him?
Remind me.
Well, he is led away, pleading for mercy, to be blinded. This is what the source says, by an inexperienced Jew who requires 3 attempts to blind him while the emperor bellowed like a bull.
Yeah.
Very sad scene. When he arose, his eyes were drenched with blood, a pathetic and pitiable sight that made everyone who saw it cry uncontrollably. And then he's sent off to exile in the Sea of Marmara near what's now Istanbul. And his eyes get infected.
He dies very quickly, doesn't he?
Not unsurprisingly. And the last thing that happens to him before his death is a Byzantine historian called Michael Psellus.
Yes.
Whose book you can get in Penguin Classics.
Yeah.
He sends him a letter. He hates Romanus and he sends him a letter. He says, congratulations on the loss of your eyes. Sort of basically kind of mocking him. Talk about kicking a man when he's down.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the end of Romanus. And that's why I think back on New Year's Day 1068 or whenever it was, when he went in to see the Empress.
It'd have been better if he'd been a monk.
He'd have been much better being a monk from the beginning.
Yeah.
None of this would have happened. Manzikert losing to the Turks.
As of course would Byzantine Empire.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Because really, Manzikert is, you know, it's a kind of death knell in the long
run. It's a landmark, isn't it, in sort of the long history of the Roman Empire.
Because it's not actually the battle itself, it's the civil war that follows.
Yeah, that sort of tears it apart.
And the Turks are able to kind of start infiltrating in.
Yeah, and from that point onwards. I mean, that said, Tom, they last for another 400 years. But
They do. But it's not great, is it? They never recapture Anatolia, the rule.
No, they
Anatolia.
Don't. Their old heartland where they used to raise all their troops from and stuff. Yeah. But even so, you know, I sometimes think with the strange thing with Byzantine history is people sort of say, after Manzikert, it was all downhill. You kind of think, yeah, but that's kind of twice as long as the United States has existed.
Yeah.
That's a hell of a long time.
Yeah, but it's on life support for quite a long time.
Yes, I suppose.
So Manzikert and the capture of Constantinople in 1204.
Well,
by the Crusaders.
That's very poor, isn't it?
Yeah, that's...
That's an amazing story, but also kind of one of the most shameful stories in European history.
It's so depressing. I can never quite bring myself to read about it.
Do you think the Venetians should give back those horses?
I don't. I think those days are gone.
Yeah. Who would they give them back to?
Exactly.
That's the thing.
Exactly.
Right. That's a very doubt. Tom, you look so crushed by the...
Well, I do. I find it so depressing that I love Byzantine history up until Manzikert, and then after that, I can't really bear to read about it.
Do you think the world would be a better place if that empire had
of course
had
it
survived?
Would. It'd be amazing. The Roman Empire. Roman Empire surviving in the 21st century.
I think, as you know, I mourn the... I think the Austro-Hungarian Empire should still exist. I think that'd be a great thing.
I'd much rather a proper line of emperors descended from Augustus.
Right. Yeah, you could be...
still a cathedral. It'd be amazing.
You could go and be a kind of civil servant or something at that court.
Well, I'd have to be a eunuch, but, you know... Maybe I suppose.
Do you not think they'd have done away with that by now?
I'd be nervous about the blindings and the...
Yeah, you would, but you'd be a great, you know, you'd be a great kind of, you'd be a great bishop, wouldn't you? Bishop of Antioch or something. I can absolutely see you as that.
That'd be a very exciting option.
Going to kind of, you know,
but sadly,
councils and debating the nature of Christ. You'd love all that.
But sadly, not a career option.
No, you're just doing podcasts.
That career avenue has been closed off and I'm reduced to doing podcasts. On which note, we should finish, shouldn't we? Because
we've just degenerated
this day,
we so often do.
And I'm sure people have better things to do on New Year's Day than to listen to mad, insane fantasies and what we'd do in a Byzantine empire that had never fallen. What would you do? You'd be a general or?
Oh, Tom, that's so kind of you. Thank you. No, I'd be doing something really tedious and some... I thought maybe I'd be a holy man on a pillar. I'd be
a stylite.
I'd be a stylite. How about
you'd be a terrible stylite.
No, I would be. I wouldn't.
You'd
be
get
a
bored.
I think I'd be a hard nosed general.
I think
like
you would.
On the Danubian frontier.
Yeah, I think you would.
Yeah,
and your troops would raise you to emperor, and then you'd come to a horrible end.
I would.
And I would glide away smiling.
You would
like Peter Baelish.
Varys in the shadows.
Yes, exactly.
I'd be Vitellius, basically. I think that's what you're trying to say, isn't it?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. You just
stopping
there.
For a snack on my way to the decisive showdown. Okay, we're going to let you get on with your new year. Happy New Year, and we'll see you again
everyone.
Tomorrow. Bye bye.
Bye bye.